I think it's also timely just to spend some time talking and just discussing, sharing with everybody on the call what we're using as resources, both within Limitless, or resources, I should say, that you have available to you within Limitless, as well as anecdotally what we have found to be successful in our firm, knowing all of you are obviously experienced in each of your respective firms, have existing relationships with a fair number of clients. This is not your first rodeo, my guess, through different market cycles. What I have learned in the years of working with advisors is it doesn't really matter your tenure in the business. Every advisor processes market fluctuations and declines differently. And so there's usually two camps of advisors. Some of them are, the one camp are completely fine during market downturns. They've done a great job of proactively educating, empowering their clients on their, not only their investment philosophy, but how that translates into what it means for their plan and the reason that the client chose to work with them in the first place. And then there's other advisors that when push comes to shove and markets kind of give us a little bit of red to look at, that they sometimes get a little deer in headlights and know what to say to clients, but have a hard time articulating that and putting that into a nicely packaged message. And so we have a couple of recorded resources on the library. Steph and Carl did a talk on how to think about scary markets. Carl also has a resource out there. If you just go to behaviorgap.com, he has a little passion project, if you will, where I believe you can sign up for his. He has a two-part series on what scary markets mean and how to talk to them. I can't remember exactly, but it's a very basic two-video tutorial that he's put together. Full disclosure, it's probably a lead gen magnet and you're probably going to get in his email list. You can always unsubscribe, but I think there are worse people that I could get emails from than Carl Richards, just my own personal unsolicited opinion. But we've got resources in there from Carl, as well as some sample client communications, a transcript from Kitsis and Carl's episode 17, where they talk about how him and Michael respectively would think about talking to clients during scary markets. Two unsolicited, or I should say unrelated platforms that I have enjoyed using in the past. Many of you probably know Nick Murray. I love the work that Nick Murray does. His writing, the prose in which he writes just resonates really well with me. I think he's very, very articulate in the way that he strings his words together, and obviously not his first rodeo through these. So the Nick Murray newsletter, again, if you're new to Nick Murray, or if you haven't, or if you're just going down this path with him, just make sure you follow the fine print on how you share his content. He is very particular about how his material gets shared with your clients and what you can and cannot do with that. Second to that, a friend of mine runs an RIA in Pennsylvania. He has started a passion project of his own a couple of years ago called Money Visuals. His name's Ashby Daniels. I appreciate his writing. Ashby, in my opinion, is kind of a mix of Carl Richards' philosophy and simplicity, as well as Nick Murray's just long-term perspective on equities, staying the course, adjusting strategically, but never emotionally for the portfolio. Moneyvisuals.com. You can take a look at some of the samples that he has there. If you decide to sign up for Ashby's service, you can use the promo code. I'm 99% sure the promo code is Lifestyle. There's a 1% chance it's Limitless, but I'm almost positive it is Lifestyle. There's a small discount. I mean, I think Ashby's charging 50 or 60 bucks a month for newsletters, couple of monthly newsletters that you can use, cut and paste into your email newsletters. So it is a little bit different than Nick Murray, but if you don't like writing your own commentary and you want to get away from what I would consider dry and unpersonable market commentary, which, let's be frank, most clients, at least in my experience, don't necessarily care about what the markets are doing. They care about what the markets means to their plan and how whatever amount of money that they have, however they're accumulating, whatever their goals and intentions are, what is happening in the market affecting their plan. And so the ability for an advisor to bridge that gap, either through writing, we've done a video newsletter using Loom. So use loom.com, right? Actually, I think it's just loom.com. We have switched from our newsletters. Instead of just doing newsletters, I will do a small little commentary. If we're making changes to the portfolio, to our model portfolios, I will do a brief 3 to 5 minute video explaining this change that we're making to the portfolio and send that out as a video to clients. It is a one-to-many way in which we found to communicate rather than having smile and dial conversations and having a conversation every single time with every single client. on changes that we're making to the portfolio, I have found that we can be, we can kind of scale that special experience by sending a video and letting them know what the change that we're making to the portfolio, why we're making that change, how it impacts the portfolio, and then give them the option if they have additional questions. We give them a couple of different days in which we will be doing client callbacks, and we can let them know if you're interested in having a conversation with either Adam or John about the change in the portfolio. They will be available for client callbacks on Tuesday from 2 to 4, Wednesday from 9 to 11, or Thursday from 12 to 1 or something, you know, whatever those windows are. And that way we can block our calendar accordingly to block that time. Clients can respond back with just a day and time that works well for them for a quick conversation. And it allows us to specifically target and spend time with clients that are wanting to have those conversations. But everybody else, we're at least able to create that specialized experience and then hearing us talk and sharing that conversation, rather than it, quote unquote, just being through the written word. So these types of market environments and changes, we have found to the ability to use technology and different modes of communication instead of just writing has created a little bit of additional experience from the client standpoint, when candidly, they probably need it most, even if they haven't really explicitly said that. So any other resources, again, I know this group is much more of a sharing group or much more of a collective community on these calls. Anybody else found any resources that they have used to share with clients during, quote unquote, scary markets, turbulent markets, that they'd want to share with the group? Or how many of you write your own content and send it out to clients?
I write my own. Depending on the market, I might write it. First of all, I only write content when markets are turbulent. So, you know, Q1 of 2020, I was writing something every week in March. I just wrote something just yesterday or the day before. But I only do it because I know clients are nervous, even if they're not asking.
Yeah.
Most of our clients never ask. And 9 times out of 10, when we're doing reviews, they're like, have you done anything with our portfolio? I'm talking about last month. And I'm like, what do you think? No, correct. Yeah. Other than rebalance for tax loss harvest.
Yeah.
But yeah. I do write something. And like when the Ukraine war started, we just put a pop-up on our website that was 3 sentences on with a quote from Mike Antonelli of Baird. So I use various resources that we run across depending on what reads well to me.
Very good. Thanks, Sharon. Mark. Appreciate it. At the end of the day, like I said, clients, they care about that information more so they care just what about how does that affect their personal plan. So we have found this as not only a time to let them know proactively what we're doing behind the scenes. This is the time to possibly think about Roth conversions for your clients, obviously tax loss harvesting, repositioning of assets. Also reminding them for our clients that are in retirement or coming upon retirement, this is why we keep that war chest. This is why we have that dry powder on the sidelines to supplement withdrawals during market corrections or ensure that anything that's invested for the long term, your short-term living expenses, the distributions that we're making out of the portfolio are not dependent. One is not dependent on the other, right? We have the cash on hand, which means what's happening in the markets is not directly impacting what we're taking out of the portfolio. Rest easy. You don't have to make any changes. We're reminding them what the upper and lower limits of their portfolio are as it relates to the distributions that they're taking out of their portfolio. Every client's going to be different, respectively. Obviously, your accumulators are going to have a different conversation than those in distribution, and even more so those in legacy and estate planning and transfer of wealth. So good stuff all around. So thank you. All right. One public service announcement. This is the fun part for me. This is what I love about running a business and what I love about an advisory business and what I think a lot of you are in a position more so than a lot of advisors that are in the lifestyle group where you're truly business owners managing businesses and advisory teams as part of your organization. But one of the favorite phrases that I think exists in business by Peter Drucker, kind of quote unquote, father of modern day management, right? What gets measured gets managed and what gets managed gets improved. And so the QBR is something that Limitless has put together that allows you to use to create a framework for how you're looking at your business through the multiple different lenses and how you distill down from a big picture, 30,000 foot view, down to the 1 year plan, down to the quarterly goals, down to the monthly objectives, down to the weekly tasks, and down to the daily action items. So how do you think about your business from the big picture and drive all that down into daily actionable items? The one thing that I would emphasize with the, or I shouldn't say the one thing, but one of the top things that I would emphasize from my perspective in looking at the QBR and the way that I have used it is I have not used the QBR. Here's what it is and here's what it isn't in my opinion. It is a great framework for you to gather all of the information that's relevant to your business, to your personal life, and to your professional life, and put it into one breathing document that gets reviewed on a periodic basis, hence quarterly business review. What it is not, what I have found it to not be, has been an actionable game plan, or I should say, let me rephrase it this way. It is not a working document that I'm going to use to measure and track the projects at hand that will get me to the point of success that I've outlined on the QBR. That is where we will take, in our firm, we will take the quarterly business review agenda items and the information in that, and eventually find that a place to live in some type of project management software. For us, that software of choice is Asana. And for that is where our personal belief, and not really that's our personal belief, it's just from a productivity point of view, that is where we have project management, where we tell who's responsible for doing what, when does it need to get done, and for which project. So Asana is that working, breathing document that tracks the progress of the things that you've outlined in the QBR. Everything that you need for the QBR, you should already have on file. This is something that was shared earlier in Limitless. If you need more information on it, grab another blank document, find the resources, the lesson that Stephanie did in concert with Tiffany and Jared. That is on the homepage of your Limitless login. When you log into the portal, you'll see that right there on the homepage. Click on that. Again, all the resources that you're going to need are going to be there, reviewing all the different areas of the QBR. The importance of that is so much so that Limitless decided to add a little bit of incentive for that, which is you will be getting a SurveyMonkey link from Lisa from the team at Limitless, which will be asking you, asking you for your QBR. You will click on that link on or before July 12th to be entered into a raffle to win one of the following, as you can see there: 2 hour coaching session, 2 1-hour sessions with Steph, a boot camp, which won't expire. We've got some ideas on the docket here for boot camps. Personally, I love doing the boot camps that we've done in the past. They are great ways to dive really deep into a couple of topics. My favorite one to do is the Build a Brand boot camp, which we've done, which has really helped advisors organize and solidify how they position their brand in the marketplace for whichever type of client that they're looking to attract, defining their avatar, quantifying it, clarifying it, and then how do they build a marketing plan around that. That's one example of a boot camp that we've done. And then, of course, we also have the 6 Yetis of Choice that you can go ahead and choose from as well. So again, that link will be coming from Lisa via SurveyMonkey. Be on the lookout for that. Send that in by July 12th to be entered into that. So,
and beyond the prizes for you guys, it's really important that you complete this so that Stephanie can take a look before your Q3 strategy calls.
Yeah, you guys get a lot more love from Steph in a one-on-one capacity than Lifestyle does, which is indicative of A, the investment in the tuition that you're paying, and B, just the number of advisors in leaders versus Lifestyle. Obviously, we could not do that in the limited capacity with just the two of us or three of us with Tiffany in Lifestyle. So yeah, that'll be really important to have that so that Steph has that qualitative and quantitative information for your reviews coming up. Any questions, Lisa? Anything that I've missed from a housekeeping standpoint? Anybody else have any questions on the information that we've talked about so far? Bueller, going once. All right. So today is retreat Q&A, which is again follow up on a lot of the work that I'm digesting this and distilling this down from the debrief that I've gotten from the team as to what you spend time during your leaders retreat. And it sounds like a couple of you weren't able to make it there, but it sounds like there's been a lot of conversation, a lot of sharing, your onboarding process, service models, et cetera. And so the point in today is, now that you've had a lot of that conversation and a lot of those items to marinate and just kind of sit there after retreat, the point today is to go through any type of stumbling blocks, any type of questions, any best practices, areas of struggle or challenge that you're feeling as a result of those conversations and game plans that you've put together from retreat around managing teams, institutionalizing, kind of building that, you know, we've used that term a lot here, building that bionic business of how do you scale special in delivering that systematized value. I'm happy to share in ways in which we're utilizing technology in our firm from a different perspective. I do feel, given the experience that I've had in working with a lot of other advisors, that we use technology in probably a pretty extreme way for our clients, which is what allows us to deliver that experience and allow us to be geographically agnostic. We currently serve clients in 29 different states and have added a number for the smaller firm that we are from a headcount standpoint. We're certainly not short on growth and the ability to utilize technology to not only manage the sales cycle and the onboarding process, but also the communication process, streamlining all of that has been a fun little journey for us as a firm as well. So happy to take this conversation in any direction that you want to go, facilitate dialogue between everybody, and feel free to, again, use the chat as the playground in which you play in. Go ahead and drop any questions that you have, comments, thoughts, and we'll take it from there. You can certainly kick off some ideas if we're struggling for that first domino to fall. Anybody want to share what their biggest takeaway was from Leaders Retreat? If anything, just because I'm curious.
I need to leverage a lot more video. Now I'm not going to talk again for the first time. Somebody else has to do it.
I can't help because I didn't get at the retreat. But I am curious, Adam, just to go off topic just for a minute. So in terms of your practice, you do all of your client meetings via Zoom. Is that correct?
Minus a very, very, very small handful. And when I say very small, I think I did 3 in-person reviews last search cycle. Yeah, everybody else is Zoom.
Okay. And so
even local clients.
Okay. And so that's, and that would include any of your newer clients, right?
Correct. So every new client has to, because they're all over the country.
Right.
Yeah.
And so have you noticed any give up in terms of the relationship that you have with your clients by doing it only via Zoom?
No. And I think the reason when you say give up, like, am I understanding correctly, like that we can't connect with them as deeply, that there's not that human,
yes,
that deep personal connection with clients that arguably you can only get when you're in person, sitting across or next from someone?
Yes.
It's hard to measure because from a true sample size, I don't have a null knot from a you know, comparison standpoint, because we since 2019 and certainly into 2020, we had shifted to all virtual anyway. I think what certainly helps us is just the intricate knowledge of what we have for our ideal client. For optometrists, like we have a certain amount of embedded goodwill and deep trust, because they get, especially for those that come to our firm because of the podcast, like they've heard me talk for 20, 30, 40, 50 hours. We have 180 or 190, I think it's 192 episodes now of the podcast. So if they've been a longtime listener, I have more goodwill and relationship with them than I could have ever developed in person, just because they've heard me talk and develop that. It's a weird relationship that happens with podcast listeners. But even if you don't have a podcast, I think you can still develop that relationship via whatever communication modality you're using, whether it's writing, speaking, doing public forums, again, even virtual in town halls. I've got a town hall coming up on Wednesday night for practice owners around the country. And so that is a way to build that credibility. So that if they do come to work with us, we're very clear on the messaging that you came because of me, you're going to stay because of us. So we very much take a team approach. They have an advisor that they're working with. That's John right now, our lead advisor. So we tell them in my first conversation that I have with the prospect, I let them know we do everything virtual. We do everything via Zoom. If you choose to align with our firm, you'll be working with John Bonesack, lead senior advisor here at our firm. He's primarily serving relationships. I'm in the backup if needed, but you'll primarily, like we set that foundation very early on. but we haven't had anybody explicitly say, I wish you'd come travel, meet me in person.
Yeah, no, it's really, really interesting. The reason why I ask is because I also haven't done many in-person meetings. And now as I think about getting on the road again, trying to decide what the real true benefit is and if it's really, really worth it.
When you say get on the road again to go meet your clients, to meet them in person at their house or at their place of business or wherever they're located?
Correct.
Yeah. It's, all of our time is valuable. And if you can deliver the same value to the client, I agree. There's no substitute for being in person with clients, but there's also no substitute for the time that we have as well.
Right.
And so I believe that with technology, yes, it's only two-dimensional, it's not three-dimensional, but when you sprinkle in the in-person, having a great virtual experience, for example, customize your Zoom waiting room to say something along the lines of, instead of just saying the host will start waiting for the host to start the meeting, instead of doing that, say you can customize your Zoom waiting room. Have it say something like, This would normally be the time that we would smile, shake your hand, and offer you a cup of coffee. We'll be right with you. Yeah, these little things that you can drop into the virtual experience to still remind them that, oh yeah, this is a relationship, and let your personality come out. That's just one example. That's what R says. You can make it however you want, just to take the coldness of the virtual experience away from it and insert your personality. For example, also a way that you can do that, that we have found really good success, not only in communicating the personality of our firm and the values and the culture of our firm, but also managing and setting expectations, is in customizing the confirmation emails and the reminder emails for your online scheduling. If you're using Acuity or Calendly or, Schedule Once is another one out there. Appointlet's a nice little piece of software. Appointlet would be one for bigger enterprises, for larger organizations. Whichever one you're using, you have two options. You can either just leave the static canned, this is to confirm your appointment with blah, 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 or you can say, we're so excited to have you schedule time. Like our triage call says something along the lines of, you may not believe it, but we're doing a little bit of a happy dance over here. That's because every year, every day that we come to the office, we're great. Again, I can't remember exactly, but our personality comes out in a confirmation email, and it just brings the person into the technology. And that comes back, as we talked about in this organization, in Limitless, of the bionic business, every single interaction that your client has with your tech, if you can customize it, is a way to bring your personality, whether it's you individually, or again, for a lot of you on the call here that run firms, the ability for you to bring your firm's culture and the communication with each of your respective advisors into that communication. So in the absence of being able to be in person, you can have more touches with your clients and let your personality come through in that way. Does that make sense? How we've done it.
No, it absolutely does. Yeah, no, that feedback's helpful.
Okay. Just looking at some of the comments here. Let's see. Meetings are 90% Zoom. Yep, thanks, Mark. The other thing that I like about Zoom calls and setting up those expectations with clients, and that I don't have to be in person, I can be anywhere I want and do a Zoom call. Did a couple of client calls from Florida. We were traveling with the family. Two weeks ago, down there for a week, did the Limitless retreat, and then had a couple of client calls from wherever. So it opens the advisor up to a lot more freedom and flexibility when you're not tied to the office. Let's see here. All right, where else do we want to take conversation? I can make it as awkward as we want and just not say anything and wait for someone to speak.
I was just going to say some of our takeaways, especially for those who weren't there, things we're already implementing, is the use of an onboarding specialist. So having one person on the team really be uber familiar with it and be a key resource for everyone else is kind of a checks and balance too. Also going in and just making sure we're not missing steps along the way. And another one, and I like the comments that you all just made about personality and brand, is that I'm working on a Friday follow-up email, which gets sent every Friday during the prospecting and onboarding process to basically let clients know, or hopeful clients know, where we are in the process. That was something, I can't remember who, but we all loved it. And so I kind of wrote it and I thought, oh, it was a little vanilla. So I need to go back and add a little personality to it. But everyone was pretty psyched about, I mean, it's such a small step, but the idea that you have money, who knows where at any given time transferring in and just giving, you know, prospects peace of mind that you're on top of it for them was another one of the kind of major things that we took away that we could implement right away.
It's a really good idea. Go ahead.
I was going to ask a couple of follow-up questions to Kim and really anybody else that's doing this onboarding specialist. I think, Adam, I think you had mentioned you guys do this maybe. Okay. Who in the firm is the onboarding specialist? Is that like their dedicated role, or is that, you know, is it an advisor or is it a CSA, or like what type of role fills that? And then same thing on your Friday follow-up. Is that done by the onboarding specialist or is that done by somebody else?
So I'll just say for us, because we're just doing it, and then turn it to Adam. We have a lead client relationship associate, and she oversees a lot of kind of the higher level stuff for that team. So she's going to serve as the onboarding specialist, and it will just be a part of what she does. We're not yet at the point where we have so many that it's a bigger role. I would love to get there, but not yet. And then secondly, I've written the template, the Friday follow-up template. So any CRA can take the template because they're processing everything for the most part and working with the advisor, and they can, you know, pick the things that were accomplished and what's ahead, which is a piece I added, like, here's what we expect to accomplish next week. And so I, yeah, just made it so that anyone could copy and paste into an email and reuse it.
Yeah, so we don't have a formal onboarding specialist in our firm yet. That is actually the next position that we're going to be hiring for, which is a combination of an onboarding specialist and a paraplanner. What we have done when we've done the math on the number of hours for our onboarding clients, we were just, this is my business planning. Everything that I have is in my notebook. And then I take the scratch out the business plan and then transfer to spreadsheets later, just because that's how my brain works. And so when we looked at the number of hours that we spend with new clients, just given the type of client that we work with, practice owner, multiple locations, a lot of irons in the fire, just the business consulting that we're doing, did I just stop sharing my screen? I think I did. No, I think we're good. I don't think there was anything on there. We're spending a lot of time with clients in that first year, relatively speaking, from a time standpoint. And so that next hire that we're going to have is going to serve as both a onboarding specialist, which will work with the client through the first year of the relationship with our firm, the first year or the onboarding process, kind of whichever comes first, which is usually the onboarding process, but then they'll also kind of shift then into a paraplanner role where they will be responsible for building the plans for John, and him or her and John will have a really good relationship on just building plans for clients that are now through the onboarding process, but still in the first year. And then exclusively for clients in years two forward, when the plan is somewhat on autopilot, but just, you know, we're just tweaking the plan from here and there, taking all the data from the various different points of tech that we have and modifying the plan. That way, John is not spending near as much time in the plan as what he is right now. And we can thus load him up with a lot more clients so that he's essentially always surging. Because right now we have to throttle, if you will, John's time and break it up so that John has time to see clients and do clients, prospects, and onboarding and onboarding planning meetings, and then make room in his calendar for some of the follow-up that Kathy can't handle or that I can't handle or anybody else. So the idea is to have someone permanently sit second chair as an onboarding specialist / paraplanner for John. Anybody else have any thoughts that they'd share on how they're doing it in their firm? No dice. All right. Where do we want to take the conversation next?
Some of my key takeaways from this last week is the biggest being to delineate between clients and customers rather than tranching off and selling off parts of the practice. We're continuing to see a squeeze on our income with our expenses as we're in this first year of succession. So that makes more sense to me. And I had a conversation with our team today about that shift in vision because they've been anticipating downsizing clients again in two more tranches over the next year. And just presenting the idea of like, this will mean that what we'll have to do is change the way that we service them. And you will have to have some sort of accountability to, as to not create a client that is unprofitable by over-servicing them. So that will be something that continues to unfold. I mean, we're naturally just like people. And so we tend to over-service. So that's one big takeaway. And the other piece is that I came away from our conversation is still like trying to figure out my fit in the firm long-term and seeing how I could make it so that I'm having more of the life planning conversations and Clinton is having more of the financial planning conversations. And then taking Kyle's model of the way that he maps out the annual calendar. I love the idea of having that annual calendar that you send out to clients at the beginning of the year so they know what to expect and just kind of fall in line with it. But then embedded within that, the ways that I can show up in my most authentic self and Clinton can show up in his most authentic self and really help clients in more of that ensemble way rather than siloed quasi ensemble. And so, yeah, just looking at how we can take the foundation that we've made with client surges and shape it even further to simplify and not necessarily have to have two face-to-faces and also mix up the advisors and all of that.
Are you and Clinton meeting with clients at the same time? So a team meeting?
No, more like topics of discussion. Right now we just have our own two separate groups of clients.
Got it, yeah, okay.
Liz, it seems like one of the difficult parts about not over-serving is holding everybody else, what you mentioned around accountability. Do you have any thoughts about that? Or have you had any conversations about how do you stick to these service standards that you're setting?
I don't exactly. What popped in my head right when you said that is we're adopting Hubly right now. And potentially using Hubly, the time frames where it like assigns you a task. This is just off the top of my head. I'm open to ideas. I could brainstorm right now in front of you if you wanted me to, but I don't think that's the point. Have you done that?
No, but as we go down this path of, you know, segments and tiers, it's something that we're thinking about of how not to overservice the tiers that we're, you know, carving out and separating from our top tier. Because, yeah, the instinct for a good advisor is to deliver everything that you can to that client.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not only the advisor. I find that sometimes the biggest pushback is from our client service folks.
Yes.
Because they also have a real attachment at times to some of the clients and just can't quite get their head/heart around a different model. So we've definitely had to do a lot of training and education and let them in a little bit on the impact financially of over-servicing. So some transparency.
Can you say more about that, Kim? How did you train?
Well, it's like I said, I didn't say this, but it's a work in progress because we're just adding this service level zero. But I will say in the past, like what happened is that people, we had advisors like assigning segments that the client wasn't really, but like they got a higher level of service. So they were kind of like sandbagging and it was just, you know, like, and then their CRAs were like, so anyway, I guess like what we've started to do was, for instance, talk about the number of hours it takes to service a client. Like when they actually walked me through and we had a really honest conversation around how much time they're on the phone with these types of clients, the running down to schedule an appointment, it becomes a little bit more apparent when they're part of the process of just putting together the time that we're spending on them. And then you translate that into dollars, you know, like their salary, like if you're working with an individual times two for, you know, if it's loaded and it's like, oh, so our revenue was $515, but just your time alone was X, right? And so, you know, it's more personal. And that seemed to kind of begin to hit. It was like, oh, I didn't really, you know, hadn't thought of it that way, let alone once we had the advisor's time, right? So that's what we've started to do, is just break it down financially in that way.
We've actually deployed a service cop, essentially. So when an advisor has a meeting, which is, there's only two of us here, all those notes get dictated along with a set of action items. And then there's a service cop review that says this meets our service standards for this segment of client or it doesn't. And sometimes we override them, although I try very hard to hold up my hand and say, nope, we're not doing it. That's over-servicing. It is very hard to do emotionally, but it's a business. We are not a 501c3.
What's easier to do? Is it easier? And again, I admit that I'm coming into this not nearly as involved or knowledgeable about your practices. So why wouldn't I just come in with some advice, right? what's easier as a firm to do? Police the service to be in line with the revenue, or allow the revenue to rise to the level of service that you want to deliver in the firm?
Well, we actually, Adam, we actually offer our clients options. Okay. So if we have like a level zero client, Liz and I have been having this conversation. I just sent her a letter that we use for our level zero. And they come back and they call in and say, hey, I want to do a financial plan. I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Here's the cost.
Our minimum fee for that plan is $6,000. And they can opt in or opt out. And we've surprisingly had a fair number of those clients say, I'm willing to pay a higher fee.
Yeah.
But for all new clients, we just will not accept a fee of less than $10,000. And that's only for a growth client who has significant growth opportunity. Otherwise, we've just set a minimum fee of $25,000, because that's where we want our average fee to be. And if you don't meet that level, you know, just not going to happen. But we do, I mean, I'll maintain those right. Level zero clients if all we're doing is sending them a letter. Otherwise, their fee is going up. It has to.
Yeah. So
I mean, our average cost per client is about $6,100. Charging anything less is actually pretty dumb from a business perspective.
Correct. Well, and so that's
cash flow negative.
Yeah, and that's that one of the biggest things that that frustrates me as a coach and as an advisor is when you see firms that have lower revenue clients and they think the solution to that is, hey, let me hire another advisor to service my lower revenue clients. It's like, well, if you weren't profitable, if you didn't want to serve them on the front end and you weren't profitable, why would you add more dead weight to your P&L on the expense side of things to service clients that already weren't profitable? Now, if you can show me with a service model standpoint and project forward, adding in the additional operating expense of a CSA to service that lower revenue client, and you still have a 20 to 25 to 30% profit margin, okay, now we're in the conversation. As long as what it sounds like you're putting guardrails around that service model, where if they're asking for things that are above and beyond what service model they're in, you're pausing the conversation and having the fee discussion with the client first. The other thing that I would support, opine on is I guess I'm going to say this, and I can see where it would come into play, where the best offense or the best defense is a good offense, right? Where you're having the proactive service model set in stone for your various different types of clients so that you're already delivering to them what they're paying for, as opposed to leaving it open for them to ask for it and then you have to say no. Like, give them the expectation of what it is that they're paying for and let that be it, rather than having to fill in and ask for what it is that they expect, right? In the absence of you setting expectations, they will. And so as long as you as a firm are clearly communicating to your various tranches of clients what they're essentially getting in return for the fee that they're paying and having that clear line of demarcation, it can, minus a few exceptions, reduce the opportunity, or not the opportunity, but reduce the possibility of those types of, for lack of a better word, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but clients just know what they're getting. That's the key. They know what they're getting for it. They know the fee that they're paying, and they have the option. Like you had said, Mark, if they want up level, if they've seen a menu of service and the cost associated with that, it's an easy decision for them to think through.
Yeah. And all a learning process, obviously, over the years. But what we do now is when we onboard a new client, part of your onboarding package is a deliverable that says, here's what you can expect from us. Here's what we expect from you.
Yeah. Client engagement standards.
We spell all that out. And of course, for our very best clients, most of whom are paying a fee of $50,000 or more, whatever the hell they ask me to do is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So we're pretty unrestricted on the top end, but in tier two and three, and now this, you know, kind of level zero, we've gotten pretty explicit about what we are and are not willing to do for what we get paid.
Yeah.
You know, part of one of the takeaways I got in this same parallel with this conversation, I like what Destiny Capital did. They, for the clients, the kids, and like the exception clients, they set up it's called Destiny Capital Foundation, DC Foundation. And it's basically they carved out like a little separate company. Like the clients are not even aware of it. And they basically charge a minimum fee based on the service model for these clients. And I think it was like $1,500 a quarter or $400,000 a year or AUM. And, you know, we're going to kind of go with something similar to that because a lot of I've been doing this 29 years and a lot of our clients, our growth comes from our clients, family members, and, you know, the people that once were exceptions and they get inheritances and stuff, they become good clients. And part of the onboarding process that we're going to have really with everybody is going to really be setting up expectations for their family members, if they want to join us, like really what the cost would be and the exceptions and so forth, and kind of letting them know up front if the because it's usually awkward if the kids want to join, like what the process is to, you know, in the past, we've just taken them and we'd be losing money on them. But I think part of our onboarding process going forward with new ideal clients is really the, you know, the process and fees if their kids and so forth want to join, you know, then this way, you know, everybody has the same expectations, you know. So that was one of my takeaways. The other takeaway that I got from the conference for those of you who aren't able to join is, you know, what Kyle did with his deliverables, he brought up a really good point. And he said, you know, instead of having so many different deliverables for the clients and trying to do all of them, he said, you know, he really narrowed them down to some of the real basic ones, but were really the ones that he wanted to do 100% right. And he was pretty humble. He said that, you know, even, you know, by limiting them, and he's got a subset of those deliverables that, you know, he's trying to master them, you know, and he's still haven't, and I don't want to paraphrase Kyle, but that, you know, even with those, you know, the less amount, he was, until he gets them 100%, right, in terms of deliverables, you know, he wouldn't add more. So I took away a bunch from that because we have a ton of deliverables for clients, and whether we execute on all of them 100% is arguable. So those were my takeaways.
I think deliverables are interesting in today's financial planning world. I think it's gone, the expectation, both from an advisor and a client perspective, has changed significantly over the last 10 years, certainly over the last 2 to 3 years, with the advent of, or the shift to a virtual experience. I forget why this came up or how I came across it, but just last week, I was going through a client file and came across an old financial plan. It's a client that's been with me for 12, 13 years. And I came across an old financial plan that I did for them back in 2011. And she was a 72-year-old. She's still a client to this day, one of my old legacy, you know, legacy clients, if you will. And at the time, 71-year-old retired teacher, single, owned her house, had $450,000, $500,000 in assets, a pension, and Social Security. And I somehow found enough stuff in there to generate like an 81-page financial plan for her. And in my mind, I'm just thinking, Adam, what the hell were you thinking and smoking at that time? That thought that your ability to deliver value was printing off an 81-page plan from Focus Plan, Financial Profiles, if any of us remember that company from Zywave. Like, what value was that in delivering an 81-page document to a 71-year-old retired teacher with a $500,000 in assets, a pension, and Social Security with a paid-off house? And I, you know, since it's probably been since 2013, 2014, I couldn't tell you the last time that we've printed out anything more than three or four pages for a client in deliverables. And now, outside of the one-page plan, which we deliver as part of our, say, as part of the prospecting process, which essentially serves as the blueprint for what we're going to accomplish as a low-hanging fruit. That's one of our, one of the phrases that I use for prospects. We say that everything that we've identified in this one-page plan is essentially the low-hanging fruit that we've identified after reviewing six key pieces of financial documentation that you've sent to us. Inevitably, as part of our planning, we're going to uncover additional planning opportunities, but we track all that virtually. We track all of that in e-money, and we track their progress in e-money, and we track the tasks and the projects that we're working on as part of that deliverable through Redtail in our CRM and with the workflows, as Liz talked about, right? Who's doing what? When's it get done and for which project? And so the deliverable for our clients is much less about the tangible piece of paper or financial plan that they get, and is shifted much more to just the experience of how they, it's the experience of how they receive our advice, right? It's those little things of the conversation. It's the collaborative planning process as opposed to a static financial plan. You talk about deliverables, and it's like, gosh, I don't even know, like, everything's in e-money. Everything is just, we plug everything in there, and they can go there and look at what we're working on and where it's at and what they need to do, when they need to do it. Everything's on their dashboard. Everything's in their task manager. The idea of printing off a financial plan just seems, I don't know, it's so antiquated to think about. The other thing that I think that helps in the context of the financial plan, just to kind of stem on that a little bit more, is when you think about the onboarding process, do clients, one thing that we found to be very impactful in helping clients understand what they were getting for the experience and for the advice was to share with them on a one-page document, not only what the onboarding process looked like, how many planning meetings we were going to have, the subject matter of those planning meetings, how we were going to implement the strategy, how we were going to monitor and implement. But then also, once they became a client and finished the onboarding process, we even labeled it and call it our integrative income planning cycle, where we just show this path of what it means to work with us and what that service model looks like. And so they can connect the dots on the value of the one-page plan on the advice, how they're going to experience that in the onboarding process on another page, and then what the service model looks like on another page. So in three pages, they can connect the dots on, here's the advice that they're going to be giving, here's how we're going to implement it in the onboarding process, and then here's how we are going to continually review, revisit, and refocus on the advice through the integrated income planning model. And just being able to distill the entire financial plan down into three pages was awesome. Bye, Liz. Thank you. What's the phrase? Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication.
Yeah, I like that process, Adam. Do you have an example of that? That three page.
Oh, I thought you'd never ask, Dave. So here is. Let me share my screen again here. All right, so. So here's our new client timeline. Everybody see this okay? So the go meeting is the first meeting that they have as a client, the get organized meeting. There's going to be some work that's done behind the scenes as well, which we tell them all is going to come from email, from our dedicated client's email address, and from Kathy through onboarding. where they're going to be get, where they're going to hold our Get Organized meeting to ensure that we have all the data in eMoney. And it's also more of our deep goal setting conversation, kind of that life planning, Kinder 3 questions. What is the big why? Like we've got an idea of to what your big why is, but now let's really start to dive deep into that conversation. That'll be part of the Get Organized meeting. Then we shift into our planning meetings. And the way I tell clients, I might have our graphics person redesign this a little bit, because I think of this more as kind of like the cascading wine glass or champagne glasses that are stacked up, right? You just pour it in the top and it spills down and spills down. The planning meetings that we have up to 4 planning meetings covering each of these respective topics. At the end of that conversation, we talk about the strategy, who's going to do what, when we're going to do it. And then once we finish implementing that, we shift into ongoing service and monitoring. Once we're through this fourth meeting, that will essentially wrap up the new client process and then move them into the integrated income planning cycle, which then we do, we for the practice, because we work primarily with optometric private practice owners that have owned their practice for at least 5 years. And so what we do in their life, personally and professionally, are very much intertwined. And so as personal and professional life changes, your plan changes with it. So we handle that change through 2 cornerstone meetings, 1 in the spring, 1 in the fall, i.e. surge, typically 6 months apart. It's a review of what we've accomplished over the last 6 months, as well as proactively planning for what you have coming down the pipe in the next 6 months. And then bookended in between that are what we have, our little micro interactions with our clients, where we're doing the proactive tax planning, reviewing the KPIs in their business, knowing their numbers, proactively managing cash flow. Those are the little micro interactions that are sprinkled in between the surge meetings that we have, very targeted, very specific subject matter that we're talking about. And then last but not least, we tell clients that we know life doesn't wait for our proactive meetings. So if something ever comes up that's outside of that, please know that someone on our team will be accessible to triage and handle any question that you have. But essentially, this is our service model that we have. We thought about doing this from a calendar standpoint, but we intentionally did not put any, like in April, we're going to do this, just to give our firm latitude and an agency to be able to change this. Because we didn't want to have to say, in the spring, that like the closest that we got to date specific was spring and fall. Everything else is a lot more fluid. But that's it. And then the one page plan, which is nothing but a glorified Word document. I can share a copy of that if you'd like me to go through that as well. But it's a Word document that we ask for 2 years tax returns, 2 years business tax returns, investment statements, summary plan document of the 401k, and KPIs of the business, their statement, like the financial statements of their practice, which subsequently balance sheet, statement of cash flow, and profit loss. So that's all we ask for in the onboarding process, or excuse me, in the prospect process. And from that, it's not hard for us to generate a page and a half of recommendations and strategies and considerations for them to think of as part of the plan, or as part of what it would mean to work with us.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks.
I was gonna say, would it be helpful if I got all this from Adam and forwarded on to all of you? Yes, no.
No, we don't want anything that would be useful for us to formulate valuable processes. Don't send it.
Everybody, but
Adam, you, what would you expect from me other than a smart ass answer?
Of course, Mark.
That's the only way I know how to function. Adam, you do all that before you get paid? I think, yeah. I heard that.
Yeah. No. The only thing we do before we get paid is the one page plan. Everything.
No, that's what I meant. I mean, you do that initial set of observations, you gather practice financials and some other data, and then you provide those initial observations before you get paid.
From this point forward, everything that I talk about is
of course. But then there's a whole initial piece where you provide some initial analytics.
Yep. But we've got that dialed down. Process. We can do that in less than an hour. We can put together a full page, a one page financial plan for an optometry practice in less than an hour.
Yeah. No, I got it. I just was trying to make sure I understood the process.
Yep. Our total prospect investment between mine and Don's time is about anywhere from 2 to 2.5 hours. From the time that the prospect schedules a triage call, that's a 25-minute conversation with me, 5 minutes to dictate notes. The one-page plan presentation that John and I have, that is an hour each. So that's 2 hours of our time. And then, so I take it back. Yeah, I'm involved in that conversation. I'm vested in a prospect. I'm invested in a prospect for 2 hours. we have a total of about 4 hours of combined team time from the time of someone kicking the tires on our firm to the time of getting to a yes or no.
Right. But you are only talking to practice owners with at least 5 years of operating history.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. So that correct. Narrows the window already.
Yeah, we just did. I was just looking at our numbers year over year. So from, and this was as of last week. So year over year, I personally did 84 triage calls, 47 of them converted into a one-page plan, and 24 of them converted into a new client. So we had a 51% conversion rate from one-page plan to prospect, and we had a 56% conversion rate from one-page plan to triage call, but only a 29% conversion rate from client to triage calls. So my focus right. in the firm is to reduce the number of triage calls.
Right. Yeah. Or increase the average fee of the clients who sign up. But yes.
Yeah, we have
accomplished the same result.
Correct. It's well, yes, I've done a fair number of testing the price elasticity with our clients and the revenue that they generate, their income. We're getting to be at that upper end, and we've scaled the model enough that our revenue per advisor hour served, I'm still profitable at about a 30% profit margin with the service model that we have relative to the fee and the assets, because we charge separately for financial planning and AUM. Okay. Two separate services, two separate fee models. Yeah. So we're charging $10,000 a year for a financial plan and then a slightly discounted, if you will, AUM schedule. So it's an and service model.
Yeah. We do the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I want to have higher quality prospects schedule triage calls.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend, because I 84, right? That's I spent 42 hours.
Yeah.
In the last year, I spent a week of my life.
Right. So a week of time when you could be taking correct. Vacation.
Yep. Yep.
So Adam, then what is your discounted fee schedule then?
75 basis on the AUM, 75 bips on the first million. And it's a tiered schedule. So 75 on the first million, 65 on the next 2 million, and then 55 on anything over three.
So question for you. So why not just have a higher AUM and wrap in the financial plan, since that's just a legacy, the higher AUM schedule.
Because a lot of our clients that have owned their practice for 5 years are very practice rich and cash flow rich, but they've just started saving. They may only have a $300,000, $400,000. Our biggest practice owner that we started working with, Our biggest practice owner that we worked with that had not done any investing, but just had a bunch of cash. We had a practice owner that was sitting with $960,000 of cash in the practice checking account, and they didn't know that they could take it out. Like, they just didn't know the basics of business operations. And then their next question is, well, how much will I pay in taxes? And I have to say, well, you paid tax on a lot of it already because you're an S corp. But so a lot of our clients are very cash flow rich, and so, but balance sheet poor. And so we had to create a fee model that was going to be commensurate to what they were willing to pay, that was going to fit our business model, but not give away the AUM side of things.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
we have some clients, because we serve tech entrepreneurs that are very, very balance sheet rich, sometimes 20 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
With no or limited cash flow because they continually reinvest.
Yeah.
So, Kara, we do something a little bit different. We charge a planning fee of 6, 8, or 12, depending on complexity of planning. And then 50 bips on the assets, but $1 million minimum. Yeah. And then we'll make some exceptions. So what it does basically is it guarantees us a minimum fee of about 11 grand.
Yeah.
And then I have some clients, like one owns a tech business, is doing 20 million in revenue, and his net worth is probably 30 or 40. But for a variety of reasons, he's just starting to generate cash. So I just charge him a flat $25,000 annual planning fee.
Yeah.
And we bill it to the business. So it's a business expense for him. And he's just as happy to have it that way. And I told him, that's our minimum fee going forward. As you build up assets, that fee is probably going to go up.
Yeah. And we charge for financial planning and retirement as well. So we still have a handful of legacy clients out there where we don't charge financial planning, but when clients retire and they sell their practice, we'll still charge for financial planning on an ongoing basis, and still obviously charge on the AUM side of things.
And generally, we actually are bundling all that into a single flat fee. We just, if a client asks how it's derived, I tell them. But for the most part, I just tell them, here's your fee for the year.
Yeah.
And we're just going to charge it in four quarterly increments, or we can bill it to the business, however you want.
The other thing that I love about,
fine. If you want to pay us monthly, fine. If you want us to build it to the business, fine. I don't care how we do it. I try.
We have really systematized the financial planning fee side of things. And we're right now, I've really ramped this up in the last 3 years. And right now we're billing, I think we're right at $35,000 a month in reoccurring financial planning fees in the firm on top of AUM. And so in these types of markets right now, it's a hedge. It's a business risk, right? There's a certain part of my cash flow in the firm has been granted net new AUM has canceled out and then some, a lot of market decline this year. We've had a really good year from a growth standpoint, but even in the absence of that, or if I was a firm that was in distribution mode where clients were in RMD phase or in that distribution phase where you've got to fight the headwinds of not only a market decline right now, but also X millions of going out in just normal distributions for your clients retiring, having that financial planning fee from a business model standpoint provides a nice business risk, a nice business hedge against market volatility and against market risk.
Yeah, same. Our revenue is effectively flat this year because half of our fees are fixed and recurring. Yeah. And we are in distribution phase with a number of clients. And fortunately, the net new money is... our net AUM is about the same now as it was at the beginning of the year.
We are not. I think we have 11 clients in RMD phase right now. So we have a younger, it's a little bit of a bimodal distribution, but certainly tier or certainly.
Well, I never built a big firm either. I mean, we have 106 clients and 20 of them are in distribution.
Yeah.
Probably. So I haven't counted.
We've bounced all over from a number of different topics here. Hopefully it's all been a good investment of your time. We still have 20 minutes or so of time here together. I believe, correct, Lisa? Or are we, we're good for 90 minutes here. So I'm happy to dive into and share and continue to talk about what any topics that you talk about at retreat, or if there's other items that we want to take the conversation. Again, I appreciate you letting me poke around in your sandbox here as leaders, and I want to serve in the best capacity that I can. So, anything else that we want to volley around here collectively?
I feel we're all very quiet this week.
Is it the midsummer blues, the midsummer hangover of just? It's the week before the 4th of July. I don't know what the weather's like, where everybody's at around here. It's beautiful and in like low 80s right now.
It's a little, we have June gloom out here in Santa Monica. And so it definitely dampens the mood for me for sure. And these markets have too, so.
I haven't even looked at what it's been like today. Where are we?
No, I mean, today we're fine.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, we're just kind of flattish.
Down 16, 11. Yeah.
I remember June gloom. I'm actually having June rain, which is very unusual for Costa Rica. It's been raining since April.
Oh gosh. That sounds awful.
I cannot deal with that. I know. I would have to have a different home away from Costa Rica for the rainy season.
Well, I did get to go to Colorado for 2 weeks.
Well, there is that, right? anything else? Like I said, I'm happy to share anything else that we've done in our firm that would be beneficial. I know a number of your colleagues had to drop off here, but happy to give you the next 20 minutes of your life back as well.
I have a really basic question, and I'm sure the information is on the website somewhere, but if someone could just point me to it, that would be helpful. Just, I want to look at how advisors, how firms are valuing acquisitions of other firms.
I think part of that, I don't think that we have a lot of content on the true M&A side of things. I think we're a little bit skinny on that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa.
Therefore, I would invite you to come to the July 15th Tribe Talks on M&A that Stephanie and Nicole from Mission Wealth are going to do. They're not, again, like I said, they're not average. prioritizing Mission Wealth during that call. They're really just talking about how it works, how they value firms. You know, if you're the firm that's looking to be acquired, the questions that you want, what you want in a partner, things like that.
Yeah, no, I wrote this. I wrote that date down for July 18th.
Are you looking to acquire or looking to? Okay.
Yeah, we're in the process. We've made an offer to a firm, but I really wanted to hear how other firms have approached that side on the M&A side. So a little bit different than, you know, sliding in a new advisor.
So it's interesting. I'm not sure if Neil's actually on this call or if he's just participating and recording.
I think he's pretending. I think he's asleep. I think so too.
Because he did join Parsons, and he would be a great person to speak on this if he's there.
I know Neil well enough that he's not here. And I'll call, because now if he was here, I would think he would call himself out to protect his own integrity. But yeah. No, he's not.
I see how it is.
I tried, but it I guess it didn't work. I think part of it is, to Lisa's point, or to what Lisa was talking about with Neil, part of it is dependent upon what the end result looks like. Is this truly a merger? Is this the acquisition? At the end of the day, any business owner, when you buy a business from someone else, you're just buying the future cash flow of that business, and you're going to sign some type of
and all their problems.
And all their problems. The phrase that I've always kind of thought of, and I haven't personally acquired a book as an advisor, but I've seen a lot of acquisitions on the optometry side of things, and how those transactions and the valuations and emotions go into that business, which let's call a spade, it's a variation of the theme. The classic phrase, I don't care what you keep, I don't care what you make, I care what you keep, I think is applicable. Obviously the business model, the profitability, revenue per client, average age of client, distribution, accumulation mode, all of those things are going to play into, is it a broker dealer? Are you an RIA acquiring a broker dealer book? Is it already a fee book, fee to fee? Like there's all those different variables that are going to play into the eventual valuation and to what extent you want that advisor that you're acquiring to be a part of the team. Like, are you acquiring the advisor and the book, or is it just the clients?
Yeah. So it's a small firm. So we're acquiring the advisor and his team and the book.
How long is the advisor going to stay on? What's the purchase agreement state as far as who has the authority and what's the relationship? What's the professional relationship look like between your firm and their firm as far as who's calling shots?
So that is still TBD. We're still negotiating that aspect of it. This person would come in as a partner. He would have equity ownership within the firm. So he would have a voice at the table, like the rest of us have a voice at the table. But in terms of his transition into, you know, post, when he begins to kind of think about transitioning out, what that would look like, we still haven't buttoned that up yet.
Okay.
But we're doing that. Okay. We're paying 2.5 times of gross revenue. Okay. Assuming we're going to have a 30%
margin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which I think is industry standard. I think the dollar matters a lot less than just what the process looks like and how you onboard the relationships and how that and the chemistry between you and the advisor, which again is a Captain Obvious statement. I know you understand that, but
and I think that chemistry, I think all that process will actually be a really smooth process. And I think culturally this group will be a really good fit. I think for me as a partner at this firm, recognizing just how expensive it is to buy a firm.
Yeah. Just from a pure dollar standpoint on what 2.5 times revenue of an X million dollar, or if it's high six figure, whatever revenue that amount is.
Yeah.
But even after debt service, you're still significantly, but assuming after debt service, you're still very much cash flow positive on the acquisition. which is why M&A has been huge and why you're seeing the insane multiples, because you have the perfect storm for the advisory model. You have incredibly low cost of capital, even with the rising interest rates. It's still historically still very, very low, relatively speaking. And you have one of the most predictable business models out there from a cash flow standpoint. So the multiple that one gives is inversely related to the risk of their capital. So the higher multiple, the greater sense of security I have around the investment that I'm purchasing, which is why you're seeing firms go for 9, 10, 12, 13, 15 times EBITDA. It's nuts. It's nuts, but it's not, because the math works out.
Well, it's interesting too, because you're seeing so many of the insurance companies coming in wanting to be in this space. And I was talking to a guy who represented an insurance company, and they just paid 20 times EBITDA. I mean, like, to me, like, that's, I don't know, that's crazy.
Well, 20 times EBITDA on an insurance brokerage firm or on a fee firm?
No, a fee firm.
Okay. Well, geez. Okay.
Yeah. No, that's what I mean, right? That's nuts, right? Yeah.
Someone got lucky. Yeah.
I mean, given a long enough runway, I guess they'll still be profitable on it. And I think that they're, I mean, I guess that's the definition of the long play, right? They're willing to pay the build versus buy cost for them. They'd rather pay a significantly higher premium on an asset that they know is going to be profitable down the road. It's just going to take them many more years to become, to reach the same type of profit margin and reach the same type of free cash flow that someone paying 14 times or 12 times would be.
Yeah, no, it's all in the math.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why you're also seeing firms like LPL just add an entirely different level to their repertoire and not being a broker dealer or not even being an RIA, but just move straight into the custody space. It's a variation of the theme.
Yeah. No.
They're just adopting to the business model, to the door, to where they're, to quote Gretzky, right? They're just going to where the puck is. They're just positioning to where this business is going as opposed to where it is or where it's been.
Right.
But yeah, which is why LPL's launched a custody only platform.
But it's also interesting too to see how aggressively Fidelity and Schwab are also moving into this space, and obviously Vanguard too. So
yeah. You
know, the competition is going to continue to only increase for sure.
And meanwhile, wirehouses still continue to control the vast majority of assets under management. Isn't that interesting, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time today, Adam.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Nice seeing you, and nice seeing you, Lisa. And, you know, of course, it's always great to see Neil.
Oh, nice shot. I love it.
Hey, we try over here.
On the M&A, what you're talking about and how you're doing it is exactly how Mission Wealth does it. Okay. Anybody that they buy essentially becomes a partner. Now they're more of a limited partner. They're not a general partner. They have limited rights in their shareholder agreement. I don't know how much detail they'll get into it in that call in August.
July.
Right, Lisa? July.
July is the general M&A with Nicole and Stephanie. Yeah. And what they do.
Oh, it's August.
Yeah.
August is the deeper dive, like the speed dating between Carson, Mission,
Mission and Journey Strategic Wealth.
Journey. There we go.
Okay.
And those might be good to listen in on just to see how they present themselves.
Yeah. No, I will. Definitely. Yeah. If I can figure out where I go to participate in the tribe talks.
We send you reminders that morning, Missy.
Okay, good. I need all the help I can get. You know that. Okay, well, good to see you guys. And thanks again for heading this up today, Adam. Appreciate it.
You are welcome. You are welcome. Thank you for being here, Kara. Appreciate the opportunity to play in the sandbox.